Who started it? What club?
There we go.
It wasn't one club. It was the Federated Philatelic Clubs of Southern California. It's all of the clubs.
So it sounds like
all of the clubs
that are federated.
Did they wear little badges?
From the 1930s.
What about the non-federated clubs?
The non-federated, they're in Klingon space.
Thank you. You made the connection.
Kaplach.
Oh. Wrong podcast.
Okay. Ready?
Mm-hmm. Let's go.
Okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Return to sender. Welcome to Stem Show here today. I'm sitting here with Scott, Cash, Brian, and Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stem Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stem Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. Let's talk about stamps. This week we are dedicating our podcast to SESCAL 2014. So Brian's familiar with SESCAL. Can you tell us how it started?
That's your cue, Brian.
Don't turn so red.
Not really.
See, now you look like a tomato.
Okay, thanks. Let's just delete all this part out.
Match his hair.
It's been around for a very long time. I have a souvenir sheet from 1954. And I think Carl found something from like 1930-something for SESCAL. So it's been around a long time.
They just celebrated their 70th year. And it was originally sponsored by the Federated Philatelic Clubs of Southern California. And it stands for Stamp Exhibition of Southern California, SESCAL. It was founded in the mid-1940s, I guess. So if there's something earlier than that, that's kind of neat. It was originally held at various locations near downtown Los Angeles. From 1959 to 1976, the show was held in what was first a Slater Hotel and then became a Hilton Hotel. In 1977, they moved to the Wilshire District and the world-famous Ambassador Hotel. And then in 1988, the show moved to the closest hotel to LAX and where it's been held for the past 22 years. And the LAX location that we were at was pretty... We were treated like kings, it felt like, in Queens, because there was someone always there to help us move stuff around, or they gave us lunches, I guess, that were included. And
It's a fun show. Lots of great dealers and great people show up, so that's one of the reasons to go there.
It was very calm. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Some shows can be chaotic. Some can be too quiet. That one is just right. I liked it.
But at the same time, I heard the dealers all say that they had really good profits and sales, and they did really well at the show. They enjoyed the show. Even though it didn't seem like it was very busy, it really was quite busy. People were spending money, and the dealers were happy with the show this time.
Then that just might be good traffic flow then in the show floor, because it didn't feel like that.
I think the interesting thing to kind of keep in mind are shows are going through I'm going to call it a little bit of a renaissance right now. A lot of shows, you got to remember the history of what has happened here. When the internet started, shows were closing down left and right, shows all across the country. Club shows that have been around for 25, 50 years are starting to see attendance drop like crazy. It wasn't really until just maybe 5 or so years ago that this trend is starting to reverse itself. And now people are starting to go back to shows. And shows that have really had been hit really hard by mid-2000s are starting to make a comeback. And SESCAL is certainly among them. And I think it's doing much better than it was even 5 years ago.
Yeah. You have to...
I think part of that's the social aspect of going to a show. Mm-hmm. Just like going to a stamp club, it's going to a show. You get to talk to other people about stamps.
Yes.
With the internet, yeah, you can buy and sell stamps, but it's interacting with other people and being able to talk about your stamps and show off what you have and meet people that you know. And it's just that's becoming more a part of the show than I think it maybe it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's why when the internet came along, we saw the dip, but then people started realizing, hey, I still want that interaction, so I'm going to go to the show.
Well, I think there's a second part of it, too, which is that as the price you pay for stamps goes up, you need the personal contact, not just to share the time of day or something, but to make sure that the stamps you're getting are real.
We all like to handle and examine stuff before we buy it or before we agree on a price.
And so
the internet doesn't allow that.
No, eBay, you have a heavy discount of things. You know, a stamp show may be going for $100, and on eBay the same stamp will go for $25 because the person doesn't know what they're getting.
And you also have a lot of sellers on eBay that don't know what they're selling. And so poor descriptions, or you know, they don't describe things that are important to the collector, maybe condition or something like that.
Well, we dealt with a dealer who, me and Brian go way back with selling stuff on eBay, and there was no way to lose money on eBay. And now people are much wiser and much more picky about who they deal with. And I think that really the stamp shows, even though they don't market it, they really need to market the contact part of their show, because that's what the main selling point of a stamp show is nowadays.
Well, I think Sesco's done a really good job of becoming a leader in this, and certainly the summer and winter APS shows are doing a great job with this, and that is offering classes as part of the show package. And I think a lot of other regional shows should consider this as well. You invite somebody from out of town who, you know, maybe your audience isn't necessarily exposed to give a half day or a 3 or 4 hour seminar about things like expertizing stamps or
Scott,
you know, how do identify stamps?
You did that at Sesco. Why don't you talk about
it? Yeah, I was scheduled for a 1 hour seminar, and I looked at the program and I ended up with a 2 hour seminar.
Right.
But it was fine. I showed up, I talked for 5 or 10 minutes, and then I opened it to questions, and we really answered a lot of questions, and the feedback I got from the attendees was fairly positive. Mm-hmm. They learned stuff and they wanted to see it, have it again, ask more questions, and they all enjoyed the Book of Secrets that I handed out.
The $100 value?
Yeah. There were some typos in there.
Yeah, but seemingly only ours had the typos. Only our little paragraph there had the typos.
I think the 2 to 4 was a typo with quote marks around it. So he went, oh, we need to fill 3 to 4 o'clock.
Yeah,
we're going to just...
And in order to get people there, we'll typo that the book is worth $100 instead of $10.
There you go.
I think more and more people are realizing that there's a demand for classes now. You see APS having their week-long summer camp, which I believe, unless I'm mistaken, they've been doing this forever. I wonder how long it's going to be before other people take tips from this and maybe have online classes or more informational podcasts like this one.
I think the desire for the classes is there, but it's a matter of the subjects that are offered. And we've just been getting a lot of popular subjects lately, so it looks like they are becoming more popular. But I mean, when you offer a seminar on the rate from the 1860 rate from Kentucky to Turkey, you know, you don't get a whole lot of attendees that are interested in that. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see more classes and topics that are geared for the beginner or intermediate level collector that are drawing in more people. And I think that's another reason why you're seeing classes better attended and more frequently attended.
Yeah,
that's true. I know I had a lot of people come by and ask about the Philatelic Book of Secrets that asked, hey, is this cover just US, just being the key word? And the first time I talked to somebody about it, I said yes, and I watched them get this disappointed look on their face and start to walk away. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute. Well, the pictures are of U.S. stamps. We talk about U.S. stamps. but the things we talk about are universal. A regum is a regum, a reperf is a reperf, and that started bringing them back in. Oh, okay. Wow, well, I can use this for my German stamps, too? Yeah, sure you can. So it brought in a bigger audience with broader topics. If I would have said, nah, it only covers U.S., would have lost a handful of sales because of that.
Okay, on the note of beginner and intermediate, you guys hear a lot about 3-cent commemoratives. So we wanted to, Cash wanted to spotlight this particular one. What are we spotlighting, Cash?
Okay. I have obviously been collecting for more than a couple years, and I have always seen the poultry industry stamp. It's a brown stamp from 1948. The Scott number is number 968. And by saying the chicken stamp, probably 95% of the U.S. collectors out there know exactly what I'm talking about. And I just thought that this was a very interesting stamp for a couple reasons. The first one is...
You had nothing else to do.
Yeah. boredom breeds... boredom and stamp collecting go together like mayonnaise and hot dogs. The stamp on it shows 1848 to 1948, centennial of the American poultry industry. And I thought that was great because I could find nothing that happened in 1848 that was related to poultry industry. They didn't start an organization. They didn't start importing. They didn't start inspections. They didn't do anything. There was nothing in 1848 that happened. So I'm just guessing that they are celebrating the 100th anniversary of the year 1848 because there's nothing else related to it. However, in 1947, the year before, the Poultry and Egg Association started. And there were a lot of political factors related to that because there was a poultry industry case that basically destroyed Franklin Delano Roosevelt's National Recovery Act. They made it all unconstitutional because of this poultry case that went in front of the Supreme Court. And after the Supreme Court ruled, basically all the NRA requirements disappeared. And I thought it was interesting, this stamp, because it reflects the change in politics. Well, it doesn't. It shows the normal sort of corrupt, industry-driven political pressures that go into hosing the system.
Isn't that also the same Supreme Court case that decided who did come first, the chicken or the egg?
I believe so. Well, Jessica pointed something out.
Obviously, they issued a stamp. Obviously, the chicken came first.
Jessica.
I haven't read that Supreme Court brief. I'm not sure.
And Jessica found out a couple things about the stamp also.
Well, the type of chicken is a light B-R-A-H-M-A.
Brahma
rooster. So I guess it's one of the earliest known breeds of United States chicken.
Rooster.
Another little known fact is that the denomination is actually on an egg. And most people think it's an oval or a circle, and if you look closely, it's not just an oval, it's actually an egg.
It is an egg. I can see it on Cash's photocopy. Excellent.
Oh, no.
So now you know far, far more about this stamp than anybody really cares about. But being the government sort of person I am, I found that intriguing.
Okay, for this week's stamp stories, we want to talk about what we learned at SESCAL. So what did you guys learn, like, from the exhibit or the show that you didn't know before? I'll start with mine. It was an exhibit on postal markings, and it had a feather and a wax seal, which meant that it was too late to go out in that day's mail, but to hurry it along, but not go by boat or something like that.
Scott, do you remember that one where they put feathers in the wax?
No.
Yeah, it was exhibit up there. I saw that one too, if I remember rightly. They said that was to mark that was express mail before there was express mail. that it was preferred to be carried by horseback rather than just by hand and to be delivered as quick as possible.
So instead of an express mail stamp, you got a feather.
Yes.
A feather on a wax seal. Yeah.
I saw something I'd never seen before that I thought was really cool. The sterilization of mail. There was an exhibit that had covers from the 1500s on up until the 1800s or so. Europe was very scared of spreading the bubonic plague.
It wasn't just Europe. You see that quite a bit.
Really?
There's a lot of covers from Hawaii where see little corners nicked off where, mm-hmm. where about maybe, a half inch up into the side. You'll see them cut off, and they will decontaminate the entire ship's hold of mail. It's amazing. It's very popular area.
Fumigate it.
Yeah, fume. Thank you for the thank you.
That's
for saying
the word.
Also, there's another cover that's very very popular where they took a nail and they would just go through an entire stack of letters, just pound the nail right in there and then pull the nail out, fumigate the entire group.
Oh. Yeah. Well, this is interesting because it was before they figured out exactly what caused disease. Mm-hmm. They knew it spread person to person. They didn't understand how. So they didn't quite understand antiseptic properties yet. It just was something that if you touch something another person touched, you might get sick. Mm-hmm. So they were flat out submerging it. Some of the ones that they had, they showed had been submerged in vinegar. There were some that had been submerged in sulfur compounds. There were some really dark brown covers that were, they said, they figured as long as you can still read the ink, you shouldn't care what's happening to the paper. They really went to town on some of them, submerging them flat out, not just aerating them or fumigating them with the gas.
Well, they didn't know about germs until the 1850s. That's one mm-hmm. of the things that I love about the exhibit that I do in the 1851 to 1859. They treated cholera, which was
one of the topics,
which is caused by sewage going into the water supply. Mm-hmm. They treated cholera by burning pitch and making foul smells. And they believed that that would help. Malaria mm-hmm. is Italian mal air.
Bad air, yeah.
Bad air. They thought that you got malaria from bad air. There are a lot of, diseases out there that they didn't realize how they were transmitted. I mean, realistically today, you have Ebola out there.
Mm-hmm.
And people in the areas that are hardest hit by Ebola don't realize how you get Ebola. Otherwise, they'd stop doing what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, the exhibit was so fascinating to me, and it was done historically, a step at a time, worded so well. I spent an hour looking at exhibits, and probably a half hour of that was at that one. And it got my popular vote. That was awesome. I love that one.
They had a exhibit on ships, and I was very impressed because it had three giclées in it.
Oh, no.
Three?
Three.
Wow.
Nice giclées of square rigger ships with stamps on them. So that got my...
That must have got your vote then.
That got my vote.
There was one guy when I was looking at the exhibits that was really pissed off. He came up. I was looking at... he did Civil War marriage certificates with revenue stamps.
Actually, that was a pretty amazing exhibit because all of those items were incredibly rare.
They're beautiful.
Wow. Except he did one... tiny, tiny, tiny little mistake.
Which was?
He forgot to mention that they were rare, so he got absolutely no credit for that. His write-up needed to be fleshed out a tiny bit more. He would have gotten the exact medal he deserved, except his write-up was just a little bit below what it needed to be.
Well, when I was looking at the exhibit, he ran up there, and I didn't know it was the owner, and he smacked the board really hard. He's, whack, damn it! Okay.
It was an amazing exhibit.
He was mad that it got silver.
Yes.
He was really upset, poor guy.
He deserved a better exhibit. he deserved a better medal, but he had everything the exhibit needed except for a decent write-up.
And that makes sense because that's why I chose the disinfected mail over that one. Visually, that one was my favorite. there were some cool things in there. Recognition of marriage between slaves post-Civil War. That was just kind of incredible bits of history. I know I'll probably never see something like that again.
Well, also on top of all that is Seskal traditionally is very, very harsh on his judging.
Really?
Yeah. They tend to be at the gold level much stricter.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas even at the APS shows where you have more judges and you think that it's a much higher level, people will take their Seskal exhibits and go to the APS show and get a grade level up. It was it's kind of always been that way. I don't know if they fixed it recently, but I know as of like last year, they were still very, very strict.
There was one other exhibit I really liked. It was an wonderful exhibit of Western local covers, which I just found fascinating. It just page after page of all the different express companies.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah, I thought that was a great exhibit. Yeah. That one also won a gold.
Well, at Seskal, most of the exhibits are going to be gold because you're at the higher level. And, you know, FIP, they're trying to get their FIP something. I'm not into judging.
I think they are
FIP. Oh, they are FIP. Yeah. So you get better exhibits in any case. And actually to see some silvers, and I saw one person got a bronze. That's actually kind of rare at a show like that. I forget what the bronze was, but that's another one where they just made a mistake. They did not do what they should have done with their exhibit in order to make the judges happy. And that's really what it is you have to make the judges happy. And if they're not happy, they're not going to give you an award.
No, it's not quite that easy. There's a certain set of standards. You're wrong. There's a certain set of standards, and they go down a checklist.
I understand what
and you either
theoretically you are absolutely correct.
You either accomplish what you're supposed to do in an exhibit, or you don't. You got two checks.
You want to know what's not on that list?
Then they just add up the points at the end.
Yeah, but you know what's not on that check?
What's that?
That list is your exhibit interesting. Okay. And I wish they would put like one little box there and say, is your exhibit interesting? And then try to have people put check marks in it. Because I have seen over and over and over again where the interesting parts of the exhibits are removed because it's a story on a background behind a stamp instead of the stamp itself. And my favorite story that I always tell is of a person had a great match in medicines. He did a medicine group. And I saw it all three times. He exhibited it three times. And the first time he got, I believe he got a silver or a silver vermeil or something like that. And it was a fantastic exhibit. I spent 45 minutes on this because it showed the stamps of every company, and then it told about the company. It told what they made, which was amazing, and how they marketed it. And information that, you know, you look at and go, man, these guys were getting away with just murder in the 1890s, advertising this stuff as, you know, give me $5 and I'll cure everything if you drink my stuff. It got like a lowish. Went in the second time, they removed probably half of the narrative, literally just scratched half the narrative, and it got a grade up. Still didn't get a gold. Went back, it got its gold. And it got its gold by removing everything that was interesting to me. I collect Dr. Jane and Sons, and it had some very rare Dr. Jane and Sons stamps. And it had the stamp, and underneath it said, one of three known. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And that got them the gold. And, I could see them at the judge's critique saying you're going into stuff that isn't stamp related. And
but that's half the reason why most people collect this sort of thing is because they find the stories interesting.
But the judges don't have that box that say, is it interesting? Check. And it's one of the criticisms that I am a judge, not in stamps. I'm a wine judge. I know the point system. I've done it for years and years and years. I understand, but if we have a wine that doesn't taste any good, it doesn't win. I don't care how many points it has.
Okay, well, on that note, tell us your story with the hashtag Stamp Stories, hashtag Sescal 2014. And now we're going to move into pre-recorded interviews that we recorded at Sescal. So you'll have to excuse the background noise. It was a loud showroom floor. We edited most of it out. So enjoy the interviews.
This episode of Stamps You're Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
Hello, I am Sean.
I am Troy.
And this is Stamp Show Here Today.
Hello, I'm here with Sergio Sismondo, and he's going to talk a little bit about his worldwide experience with stamps. So what exactly do you do with the stamps?
I spend most of my time studying the stamps for their authenticity, to determine whether they are genuine or forgeries. That is my main preoccupation.
What is the best stamp that's ever come across your table?
There was a sale in Switzerland 2 years ago when they sold a stamp of Sweden that was the most expensive stamp ever sold in the world before the British Guiana 1 cent magenta fetched nearly $9 million this year. But at that time, this was the most expensive stamp in the world. And the person who bought it wanted definitely for me to issue a certificate of authenticity as soon as he bought it. And so that's the most important stamp that I have ever certified.
What made it special or rare?
It's an error of the first stamp of Sweden. So first of all, the first stamp of each country is particularly popular. And many people that are well-heeled pursue collections of the first stamp. For instance, the United States, number one, is the subject of collections that are worth millions of dollars. And people in the East Coast or the West Coast or the North Coast, they can collect the number one U.S. Well, it's the same in Europe. So the number one Sweden is a very, very important stamp for the Swedish people. And this is an error of number one, and there's only one known. So it is unique in many, many ways.
Wow. So what's your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
That's actually a rather interesting story. When I was I think it was on my 12th birthday, but I don't remember exactly, but I think it was, that my father gave to me a collection of stamps, a very small collection, probably only 10 or 12 stamps. And he said that I should not damage them in any way, and I should take as much care of them as anything else that I ever owned or anything else that I will ever own. And because he said to me that at this time they were not worth very much because it was just the end of World War II and that Japan was an impoverished country under Reconstruction. And the stamps were of no significance or importance in Japan. But he said to me that someday these few little stamps here will pay for your education in university. And when Japan gets back on its feet, I remember his very words. And in fact, what happened is that those stamps that when I first got them were only worth perhaps $1 or $2 each, are now worth in the many high hundreds or even thousands of dollars each. And his other concept also came true because on my second or third year in university in the United States, when I was studying physics, the stamps came in handy and my father asked my permission to sell them in order to pay the tuition for the following year. And he did. He did very well with them. By then, I had enlarged the collection a great deal, but it was all sold for to pay for my education, yes. It was exactly as he had predicted.
Do you have any advice for people that collect stamps from around the world?
Yes, I do. I think that the principal advice is to pay a great deal of attention to quality. To look for stamps that are not damaged. If a stamp is damaged, try to replace it. It's not that it's worth nothing. That's not the point. The point is that the collection as a whole is going to be worth a great deal more in the future if it is built with a criteria of quality. And so it's very important to understand the quality. The quality varies from country to country. In some countries, centering is very important, especially, for instance, in the United States. But people pay more attention to centering than almost anything else. In England, the stamps are considered to be superb if their color is fresh, if they are as fresh as the day they were born, so to speak. Then that stamp can be called superb, no matter what the centering is like. A stamp can be described in an auction in England as being superb and yet very badly centered, which in the United States would be impossible. In other countries where stamps come generally with defects, say that somebody collects Indian Native States, most classic stamps of Indian Native States have some faults. So the issue there is nothing more than trying to minimize the faults, make the fault as little as possible. And occasionally you find a gem that is completely unfaulted. And that stamp should be the gem of your collection of Indian Native States if it's absolutely perfect, yes. So in each country it's a bit different. You should learn what the criteria are for each country.
Okay, and if I need help identifying a stamp, let's say it has just a face or some artwork and no numbers, no country or anything like that, you can help me with that?
Absolutely, absolutely. We know all the stamps. All the stamps from the very beginning, May 6th of 1840, all the way to about World War I. There are approximately 200,000 stamps issued. And I have to admit that I have either owned or at least certified or seen all of them. So.
Wow. And how might someone get a hold of you for your help?
Just in the internet, www.sismondostamps, one word, .com.
Okay. And you grade the world, right?
Yes, we study all the stamps from 1840 to about World War I.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and I appreciate your time, and I've learned a lot about worldwide collecting.
Well, thank you very much.
Hello, I'm here with Bill Jansen. He's been running the youth activities over here at SESCAL, and I had a couple questions for him. He's generous enough to come on over and answer them. So I'm going to start off with, what advice do you have for beginner collectors?
Okay, for beginners, you want to start simple, a small album, start with moderate stamps, collect what you like. If you like topicals, horses, dogs, baseball, football, Disney, collect those. Hagner sheets are good because you don't have to put them in with hinges. You can just move them around and you rearrange them any way you want. Keep them in there, or have a small album, you can hinge them in the album. Learn how to do hinges, learn how to soak stamps. Have somebody mentor you that knows about stamps and can show you things. And if not, use the internet to get information from the APS and some of the other sites that have information for beginners.
So what age do you recommend people start stamp collecting?
Well, I'd recommend they start it before they're born. I learned that from my niece. She called me up and told me, when are you going to start my kids stamp collecting? And I said, they're not born yet. And she said, that's a good time. So I started sending first day covers, and she would put them in an album. And when they were born and as they grew up, she would show it to them. And they just kind of naturally grew into stamp collecting. Then I started sending them little packets of stamps. And every time they got them, they would take them and they just love them and sort them out and put them on pages. And now they're 14 and they love collecting.
So I noticed you have several materials over in your corner. What kind of materials are out there for children?
Okay, we have a lot of stamps. I have Prexies, which is the presidential series, and I have a page that I have the kids take the stamps and put them on the pages with hinges. And then I have another set that is more common stamps, regular issue stamps, and I have several pages, and they can pick one and then look for the stamps and put them on the pages. I have a bunch of first day covers that they can take some for free. I have another pile of foreign stamps and some U.S. that they can go through and take all the stamps they want, no charge.
And there's some comic books over there I saw?
Yes, the comic books are related to the Celebrate the Century stamps that the U.S. issued in the 1990s. Up to 2001, maybe, I think. And each comic book relates to one of the decades in the 1990s, from the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And you look at the comic book, and then they had another small page that you would vote for the stamps that you wanted to be printed. And then they would tally the votes and print the stamps that got the most votes.
Oh, so that series was left up to the children?
People.
Oh, the people. Okay.
You know, children were part of it, but it was also people. So anybody could vote.
Oh, I had no idea. I just thought they arbitrarily just printed them off.
No, they chose the subjects for the first five decades, and then they let the people choose the subjects for the next five.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was cool.
What's your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
When I was younger, I was about third grade, my mom started me collecting. And I remember I got the Martha Washington stamp. That was a big deal because it was the first stamp that I ever acquired that was worth more than basic catalog value. It was a nickel at the time, and the basic price for a stamp was 2 cents.
Oh.
So today it's worth a couple bucks. So
So what stamp do you have in your collection that you would not trade or sell for the world?
I have a Nepal postcard, number one, that I wouldn't trade. There's only a few of them, though, and less than 10.
What does it look like?
It has the design of the cross kukris, like the regular issue, but it's imprinted on the card. And then it has a horse in the center at the top. And then there's an arc that says Nepal postage.
Oh, wow.
But they're kind of crude, but they're neat, too. There's 22 different varieties, and this is the first one that we know of. We think it's the earliest, and it might just be a proof, but nobody knows because there aren't any records, and nobody's around to tell us.
Well, you can't go wrong with a number one of something.
That's true.
I just learned. The first stamp in any country is worth collecting.
Yes. A lot of people just collect number ones. That's another topic that people do.
I heard that you guys go to schools?
There are seminars, schools. We had a seminar here before the show on revenues. Last year there was one, and the year before. And the Philatelic Society of L.A. underwrites it, so you get in cheaper. It's normally about $200, and you can get in for about $35 or $40. So it's a good deal. So next year would be a good deal for people to go to it, because it is really cheap and you learn a lot, even if it's not your specialty.
Okay, well, it's been really nice interviewing you. Is there any resources that kids can go to that you know of to find out more about stamp collecting?
The APS website, I believe it's APS.org, and Virtual Stamp Club. The APS has stamp pages you can print. They have a lot of advice for kids and games for them to play.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about your society. That's what it's called, right?
Okay, yes. Well, I'm the president of the International Society for Japanese Philately, and here in the Southern California chapter. We just started about a year ago here. We are all collectors of Japanese stamps. We started when the society came here, and we got together, and we enjoyed the presentation that Lois Evans had on expertizing Japanese stamps, and we got together every month since. So we have a organization that gets together in people's homes on once a month on Sunday afternoons, and we talk about Japanese philately, and we share our stamps and stories about our collections.
Okay, I forgot to go ahead and mention your name.
And yes, I'm Ed Kawasaki.
There we go. So, why Japanese? Why did you start collecting Japanese?
Well, I started. My name is Kawasaki, of course, so it's a Japanese name. And my grandfather was Japanese. And so when I was small and growing up, he would give to me some of these Japanese stamps. So when he was corresponding back to Japan, he would collect the envelopes and stamps and give them to me. And that kind of got my collection started. So I appreciate what he did.
Okay, and what's your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
Well, that's probably it, the collecting of the stamps from my grandfather. And like most people, you start as a kid and you collect all kinds of stamps and get them from different places. And then as you get into college and get married and have kids, you kind of fall away from it, as I did, and then got back into it some years later.
Okay, tell us what stamp in your collection that is priceless to you.
Well, probably the early stamps that I got from my grandfather. They don't have any financial value. They're common airmail stamps from Japan, but because my grandfather gave them to me, they're kind of special in my collection.
I was looking at the Japanese stamps you have over at your booth, and a lot of them have a flower shape on them. What kind of flower is that?
That'd be the chrysanthemum from the Japanese emperor. It's the symbol of the royal house. And you see that a lot on the Japanese stamps.
Oh, okay. I thought that was like a... My guess would have been like a cherry blossom or something.
Well, a lot of stamps do have cherry blossoms on them as well.
There's a kind of a name change that goes on. It goes Japanese Imperial, and then it moves on to like Nippon, or how did that?
A lot of the stamps you'll see are arranged by the emperor, and so it would be by the era of the emperor, so like the Meiji era, and they have their classification and ages based on that.
I saw that you guys have a publication on your table. What's the name of that?
Yes, the Japanese Philately publication of the organization, and it's an excellent publication, and it contains stories of new stamps, of old stamps, of cancellations, and it's all of the members get that, and it's well worth just the cost of the membership just for that publication.
I also saw there was an article about fakes and forgeries. Are those common?
Yes. Many of the early stamps are not genuine. They were made for tourists. They had tourist sheets, and we have one at our booth that we have on the table that was meant for tourists that came to Japan, and they wanted the samples of Japanese stamps. So they got some of the current stamps, and some of the older stamps were all manufactured specifically for the tourists. So they're reproductions. And then as you'd get some revenue stamps mixed in there as well, because they look very Japanese. They're all in Japanese writing. And so the tourists would buy those and take them home as souvenirs. And then later they ended up in philatelic collections, and a lot of them are really fakes. So if you look at many of the early stamps of Japan, about 90% of those you'll find are really not genuine. They were made for tourists rather than for postal use.
Is there a quick way to tell if you have the genuine thing? Or
Some of them are easy to identify because they'll have copy marks on it, a little small secret mark that they put on there to say this is a copy. But many of them don't, and many of them are very hard to tell from the originals. Fortunately, we have here in Los Angeles Lois Evans, who's the expert on identifying the early forgeries of Japan, and also is a member of our club, so she's able to give us advice on which are genuine and which are not. And she's going to be holding some seminars for us as well, so we can build our own expertise on how to identify these fakes and forgeries.
Wow. So what's the best way to get in touch with you guys if people want to join?
Probably the best way is to send to our email address, which is ed@epk.co, and we will send you information and we'll put you on the distribution list of when our club meets.
Okay, well, thank you so much for this time. It's been a very informative interview. I had no idea that something so beautiful could be fake or real.
Okay, well, I enjoyed talking with you, Jess.
I'm here with Carl Schaff, the chairman of the Sescal Stamp Show, and he's going to tell us a little bit about what he's about.
Well, Sescal is a long-running stamp show. It's been around about 75 years. It is a national-level stamp show, WPS. We have a bourse where there are lots of dealers from all over the country and a couple of out-of-country dealers. We have an exhibit room upstairs with 200 frames of exhibits. The winner will compete with the other winners of the national level stamp shows for champion at champion. And let's see, we had a class on revenues. We have a different class every year, which is an APS class. We bring them in. It's 2 days on a specific topic. We have meetings. We're hosting two international societies, Erie for Ironman and the Scandinavian Classics or Collectors Club.
I heard there was a banquet too. What was that about?
Well, we had a banquet where we give the awards out for all the exhibitors, and it's basically my job as host of the banquet to make sure everybody's thanked and everybody gets their award.
What did they receive? What does the winner receive? Like, what award categories are there?
There are what we call medal levels, going from low to high. You have bronze, silver bronze, silver, vermeil, and gold. They are judged by national level judges. We often have FIP qualified judges on our panel. We have, I think, two or three of the five judges are this year, and I may be wrong, maybe all of them. The top exhibit gets the grand, and different shows give different prices or things. We had a very colorful vase that was bought in, I think, Milan. The reserve grand, which is the number two multi-frame exhibit, I should mention, there are multi-frame, which is 3 to 10 frames, and there are single frames. A frame is generally 16 pages of stamps. They're not quite 8.5 by 11. They're a little bit bigger. But that gets technical on how you use space and whether you use 8.5 by 11 or 8.5 by 12. Or it's 11.5.
Which one caught your fancy? Which frame?
The exhibit, and I believe it was the reserve grand winner, on the cancellation, the flag cancellation of the United States. It was a whole series of the progression of the use of the flag as a canceling device. Very, very well done.
I saw the, I believe it was revenue stamps on marriage certificates during the Civil War.
Mike Mailer's exhibit. Fantastic. He has really opened up the revenue stamps on document in all of his exhibits. He's gone to the Champion of Champions with his exhibits. Just tremendous, very wide range of revenues. I think one of his exhibits up there is on the Oregon revenue stamp, state revenue. He called it, I think, Bigfoot on stamp, something like that.
Yeah, I even saw, I'm sure they're hard to find, the Civil War marriage certificates recognition. They're not even like from a ceremony. It's like after the Civil War, African Americans were allowed to be married, or
blacks were not allowed to get married when they were slaves. And obviously after the Civil War, they obtained all the congressional and national rights, constitutional rights, and they got certificates that were showing they were married. they're not common. I mean, you've got to dig far and wide to find them. And he has a couple of frames of them. It's fantastic material.
It looks like years of work.
Yes. Any of the exhibits that are up there is a labor of love that goes on for decades. And I speak from personal experience. I've exhibited 19th century use plate number items, and it's decades to put an exhibit, to get the material for an exhibit. There are exceptions to that rule, but it's there.
I spent, I think, 3 hours up there, and it wasn't nearly enough time. People are having a lot of fun here. I thought it'd be kind of quiet. They would, like, pick a corner and whisper. No, people are having a ball.
The stamp collecting is and can be a very social hobby. Most people think of it as geeky old men. That part may be correct, but it's not someone who goes, buys a group of stamps and sits in a room putting them into an album. That is part of it, but we go to clubs, we go to their societies, we go to lectures, we give lectures, we go to shows. A lot of people you meet become friends, corresponding friends and personal friends that go on for a lifetime.
So I was wondering, what is your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
It's with the start. I started when I was 6, but my older sister collected stamps, and I wanted to stamp, and I was begging my mother to let me collect stamps for a couple of years before it finally started. It's a wonderful story, at least I think so. They finally agreed. They didn't tell me until it happened, and one of my father's friends, who is a stamp collector, was willing to come in and mentor me. And I was 6 years old, and I got a Scott National album, which is quite advanced for a young kid. He brought in the three different album pages for U.S. We had talked about what I wanted to collect, and that gets into, you know, the first rule of stamp collecting is there's no rules. And then we break those rules very quickly by saying, well, you collect and decide what you want to collect.
So I noticed that you guys have a kids exhibit. I haven't seen that before. Who runs that?
Well, the APS in the exhibit have a whole category for youth exhibits. We used to have real competition, which would mean anywhere from 3 to 10 exhibits of youth material. But getting children really inspired to get to that level takes a lot. When I first became chairman, we did not even have a youth room, a portion of the bourse for youth programs. That was the first thing that I wanted to correct, is to put that in. And I drafted Bill Jansen to create and reopen, and we helped fund him. And he taught school, and he had a stamp club for children at school. And I'll tell you, he did create it. He's got a youth program here, and with that we got the exhibit. And because of all the work he's done in trying to get children involved, I awarded him the Distinguished Philatelist Award for the Federation at the banquet that we talked about. I had been last year's recipient, and as last year's recipient, I was the leader of a committee, the head of a committee, and I steered it towards him because he's done a wonderful job, and I think he should be distinguished. Maybe you'll get another podcast with him. There are a lot of collectors in the room with a lot of different areas. I mean, you talked about the exhibits upstairs. They're all over the place. I mean, I'll give you an aside of another story. I collect, as we discussed, American stamps, traditionally. I think that is the high end of stamp collecting, to collect a country or an issue or something like that. And they have first day covers. And I love the First Day Cover Society, but I had always thought that was one of the lower ends. And about 20, 30 years ago, topical collecting came in, and I even thought that was below the First Day Cover. This is my prejudice. This was wrong. So I go up, and I finally get my gold in my thing, and I'm invited to the Collectors Club to join. And the president, the chairperson of the Collectors Club, was Marion Bowman, who won. Her exhibit was on Martin Luther, 10 frames. Now, I'm proud I got a gold at the national show. She has an international large gold in a topical Martin Luther. Remember, I thought this was the lowest of the low? So far above me, I reevaluated very quickly, and I learned none of this is, quote, garbage or low end. There is a place, as rule number one says, collect what you like, and it fits in, and it fits in all the way up to the extreme end. So if you're interested in, let's make something up, you're interested in sports and people, so you want to collect sports on stamps, people, sports figures on stamps. It's a topical. There's a topical, national level topical society, the ATA, and they probably have a list of all the people on playing sports on stamps all over the world. You can put a story together, a topic on it. And it can start just because you saw Babe Ruth on an American stamp.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to bid you adieu, and thank you so much for your time and expertise.
I hope I can bore you on another podcast and talk about a specific area in U.S. collecting. There's a lot to talk about. I want to inspire you in closing to come to SESCAL next year. It's obvious it's not going to happen this year. It's usually in October. Next year it'll be October 2nd to 4th. We have it at the Hilton Hotel at the airport in L.A. Come. We have a special rate. I think it'll be $91 per night. So if you're hearing this, let's say, in Indiana or in South Africa, it's a good show. It's a good hotel rate. We got the rate 3 days before, 3 days after. Bring your wife. Get to go to the show. Take her to Rodeo Boulevard or Avenue and have her buy her coach purse. And you can take the kids to Disneyland and tell them if they behave during the show while you're buying your stamps. Assuming you're that typical older male. If you are young and local, we want you to come in and become a volunteer, help the committee, because that's how the show gets put on.
And where can they find information about it? Is there a website? Or
we have a website, sescal.org. That's S-E-S-C-A-L period O-R-G. And we update it. There's also a website or Facebook page for PSLA, which is the Philatelic Society of Los Angeles. I didn't get anywhere into talking about clubs that are local. There are lots of them. Some are by country, some are by topic, some are general clubs. PSLA is one of them. Come join us at one of the clubs.
Okay, well, thank you again.
My name is Bill O'Connor, and I'm a member of the Era Philatelic Association, which is an organization that promotes stamp collecting for those interested in Irish stamps.
Okay, so what makes the Eyer Philatelic special?
Well, we were formed in the early 1950s, and it was about three very interesting people, I think one from Ireland, one from America, and one maybe from Great Britain. And so the organization grew from those three people to, we probably have in excess of 300 members now worldwide. And we meet every year at an annual meeting, and this year we decided to meet here at Sescal in Los Angeles.
So what's the earliest memory you have of stamp collecting?
My earliest memory has nothing to do with Irish stamps, but it has to do with the Olympics of 1956. And I remember being at some kind of a secondhand store in Kingston, England, Kingston-on-Thames, and the gentleman gave me a package of stamps, and the Australian Olympic stamps were included, and I just said, "Whoa, these are neat." And so I started collecting that topic, and for many years I kind of focused on the Olympics.
So what stamp in your collection has the most value to you, whether or not the Scott catalog says it does?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Probably, and it does have a fairly high value, but I save Irish stamps, but I also save English stamps used in Ireland, because Ireland at one time was part of the United Kingdom. And I do have a £1 brown Victoria, which is the catalog is fairly high, but it has a wonderful Dublin cancellation on the stamp. So that's kind of why I was able to get it a few years ago. So I'm very happy with that stamp.
So in your club, what's the most you've learned? Like what did you learn that surprised you about collecting?
One thing is, you never know what interests people. And I think as a collector, we should always promote what other people want to collect. Don't try to restrict them as to what I like or what the society likes or what the organization likes. Kind of allow people to collect what they want and promote it, because I think it's a very internal thing. And, you know, collecting is very personal. And most of us, I think, do it for the history. And some of us do it for the printing. Some of the stamps are printed beautifully. And then some of us do it for a value. We think it's going to be worth some money perhaps in the future. But I think that it should be something that interests you. And don't let it get over, beyond. Don't think that you're going to, you know, become a millionaire by your collecting. But think it's going to be, you know, just a fun activity. And that's one thing about the EPA, is that we do meet and we have a good time. And I think that that's more important in some respects than whether my stamp is a good stamp or whether I win a gold medal in an exhibition. Just have some fun.
I've seen on the covers from that region that there are some really interesting kind of cancels or postal marks on it. Which one do you find the most interesting? Yeah.
Well, going back to the English usage in Ireland, there are what we call numeral cancels. And each number, like 186, refers to Dublin, Ireland. So if you see a stamp with a 186 on it that's in a diamond shape, that came from Dublin. If you find a cover with that, it's much easier, because you end up having the entire cancellation on the cover. So many people will only collect the cover because it's the complete cancellation. But it gets pretty pricey sometimes. So I like to get the stamps if I can.
I saw one that said "too late" on it, and it had a black seal on the back, and it looked like someone had died, like the letter didn't get there soon enough, and that the person had passed, or it was bad news, or...
Oh, well, it may have been a morning cover where you have a black tinge around the envelopes. Those were very popular in America and Europe, you know, after the Civil War and up to about World War II. And so that may have been... There's also some cancellations that you were too late to get the first post. So if you paid a little extra in the old days, then you would get the special post, because they were probably a little more efficient at getting the mails, particularly in the cities. Some of the cities would have 3 or 4 deliveries in one day. And now we're lucky to get one. you know, that's, I think, because the focus was to get things done quickly and cheaply in the old days. Now it's a little more expensive to post your letters.
So they'd miss the outgoing mail for that morning or something,
yes.
And so they got that.
Yes, yeah.
And that expedited their letter?
Absolutely. You've got a good way of putting that. Also, in some cases, you pay a little extra to use a fast train. So the next train, and there were special boxes for that train so that they could pick up the mail. And we had similar things here in America as well, but I'm more familiar with the ones in England and Ireland.
Do you know what the most exotic way they had of transporting mail?
Probably a friend of mine collects tin can mail, and that's out in Samoa or somewhere in the Pacific. And they used to have the native people would swim out, or they would take the canoes out to the ships because the harbor was too shallow, and they would transport mail and then get mail coming in and then skedaddle back. The problem is that sometimes the sharks would interfere with the movement of the mails, and so they had to change that at one time. I think they used to swim to some degree, and then they went to canoes, and nowadays I think it's all done by air because they got the airstrips now.
Wow. That is the most exotic way of transporting mail I've ever heard of.
Well, there is a pigeon mail, too.
I've heard of... Yeah. Well, there's always courier, but like camel mail.
Yes.
Or, you know, of course, Pony Express with the horseback riders. And I've never heard of tin can mail before.
well, good. I mean, the island where this was most done had an explosion with the volcano in the end of the war, about 1945, in that neighborhood. And so the whole island had to be evacuated. So it's kind of neat, and I think they may have come back, you know, but I don't think they do the tin can mail. But it used to be the American ships used to, the Matson Line, which is an American line, used to be able to take passengers, and you would see the stamps, and you would see the name of the ship and the like, and it's kind of neat to come across something that went through that kind of process.
If someone's interested in joining your association, how would they go about doing that?
The best way is probably to look us up on the web. We have a web page, aerophilatelicassociation.org, and I think that would be the best way of doing it. You can also go online and find various addresses. Here locally in the Los Angeles region, that my name is attached to the local, and so my address sometimes gets out. And so if you find an address of Bill O'Connor, that's probably because I've lived there so long in the same address. That would be a good way of doing it. Plus, at certain stamp shows locally, we show up. So here's Sescal at Palpex, which is in Poway, California, and then the San Diego show, Sandical. So we do try to be visible, and we welcome anyone. Even if you don't save Irish stamps, we'll corral you as a member. And sometimes it's heritage sorts of things. Sometimes it's just fun, you know, have a good Guinness or something along with your stamp collecting. So,
sounds excellent. You guys are a really fun, loving group of people. Looks like your table's having the most fun sometimes over on your side of the showroom.
Well, I think that's part of the collecting element. And we had the banquet for the award ceremony tonight here at the LA Hilton, LAX Hilton. And, you know, whether we win anything or not, although we probably get disappointed sometimes, it's still the camaraderie, the fun, the enjoyment, talking about stamps, talking about the history behind things. And there's a lot of references to Ireland and Irish people here in America. We have a lot of people that have their name on stamps. One person that comes to mind is Augustus St. Gaudens, who was the sculptor who did the $20 gold piece, the very famous, but he also did some beautiful, the Shaw Memorial in Boston, and I just recently got his signature on a letter, and I said, that's Irish, because he lived in Ireland for 6 months when he was a baby, and then he came to America and did extremely well. So,
okay, well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a wonderful chat.
Well, we appreciate it, and thank you for having us.
I'm here with Michael Motisha from the American First Aid Cover Society. Can you tell us about that group?
Okay, I belong to the Reese chapter here in Southern California, which is part of the American First Aid Cover Society. and we have about 80 to 90 members, and we meet 4 or 5 times a year, plus going to stamp shows and various other ceremonies and functions in the Postal Service's community operations.
So do you guys create them or you just collect them?
We create first aid covers. We draw the cachet that's on the left-hand side of the envelope and place the stamps on them and then get them canceled at the first day ceremony. And the various cachet makers, or first aid cover makers as they're called, trade, sell both of those types of things with their covers.
So what cover do you have that you're proud of?
The cover I think that I'm most proud of is a Lewis and Clark cover, because the Lewis and Clark stamp is a birthday stamp of mine. It came out on May 14th, and that's my birthday. It didn't come out on the year of my birth.
Oh, okay.
But it came out on the day of my birth.
And that's kind of special.
I collect birthday stamps and birthday first day covers.
Wow, that's really specific.
I also send birthday stamps out to other people in the club, and when I send birthday cards out, I put a stamp for their birthday in the card.
Wow, that's really special. I guess I'll have to start sending actual covers instead of emails for birthdays.
I'm an old school. I like mail. I love mail. I dislike computers. I dislike texting. I don't like emails. I like a stubby pencil.
Oh, there you go. So how long have you been collecting?
I started collecting when I was about 8 years old. Used to buy my stamps at a cigar and newsstand on State Street in Santa Barbara. And at various times I had to put them away, like when I was in the military for away from home, or I was at college and doing other things, or my kids were growing up and I didn't want them plastered all over the walls. So I've done it off and on, but since I retired I now have full time to devote to my stamp collecting, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
So what's your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
Probably going down on the bus to the cigar and newsstand and going in the back of the room with this older gentleman and buying stamps from allowance and pop bottles that I saved. And I don't think any parent would want their child going in at 8 years old into the back of a cigar stand and newspaper stand nowadays. But that's how I started collecting. He sold stamps to us, a little group in the neighborhood that did that.
So they were all used, or they were worldwide all stamps?
No,
or?
The U.S. Mint.
Oh.
Mint stamps. And they were very plentiful during those years, the late 40s and early 50s, because they were mass-produced and they sold for a penny or more than the 3 cents they were valued at. You can still buy them at a penny or more because of the quantity and volume that were produced during those years.
So if someone wants to join your society, how would they join?
Come and see me. I'll get an application and sign them up. There's a dues each year, and we have an email website for the club, and we are known as the Reese Chapter, the Club That Eats. We were given that name by Foster Miller, who is also a member but lives on the East Coast, and we have dinners and party feeding festivals after every one of our get-togethers. So
I was wondering what all that noise was in the hallway there. I guess you guys are really just a really bunch of fun-loving people.
Yes, we are.
Like, those guys over there are definitely having too much fun at a stamp show. So for those of you that think stamp shows are just quiet and, you know, everyone just whispers, that is not the case.
No, not at all.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciated hearing about your group, and we look forward to seeing you again at the next SESCAL.
Thank you.
I'm here at SESCAL with Steve Lund, and he wants to talk about his group. Can you tell us a little about your group?
Well, we're the Scandinavian Collectors Club, and we collect stamps from Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Faroe Islands, Greenland, the Danish West Indies, Iceland, Finland, and Oman. And we're a club of 650 members. 433 of them live in the States, 40 in Canada, and the rest abroad.
Okay, can you tell us about your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
Well, my grandmother got me started by buying a stamp album for me in the early 60s. And I became a collector, and I got some stamps in the mail from H.E. Harris and other approval things. But by the time I was 15 or 16, I was really more interested in the trombone, so I left the stamp collection on the table. But I enjoyed stamp collecting when I was younger, and came back to it later then. I think getting an early start can be to have a positive experience. When you're young is important for stamp collectors.
Okay, what stamp do you own that you would never part with?
Oh, there's too many of them. My favorite stamp in my collection is a gray standing lion from Sweden with a cancellation on it with my name on it. It says Lund.
Is there a town named after you? Or?
Yes, it's Lund is in Sweden, although the Swedes would say Lund is the actual name of the town. But that's my favorite stamp in my collection, for sure.
Oh, wow. That's neat. I wish I had a stamp with my name on it.
Well, I have an exhibit upstairs here at SESCAL with 80 pages of stamps with my name on it.
Oh.
I'm a little bit eccentric, I guess, maybe.
No, I mean, whatever's fun, you know.
Well, that's what's great about stamp collecting, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. How might people be able to contact you guys to join or ask about a membership?
The best way would be to find our website, which is www.scc-online.org. I'll repeat that. www.scc-online.org. It's the website of the Scandinavian Collectors Club, and there's information about the club on the website. Also, you can find an online application.
What kind of activities does your club do?
Well, we have annual meetings at major shows every year. We have several chapters in various places across the country. Myself, I live in Minnesota, and we have a chapter in Minnesota. We meet at the Danish American Center in Minneapolis the second Thursday of each month at 7 p.m. If you're in the Twin Cities area, we welcome you.
So do you guys meet over dinner, or is it just a social gathering? Or?
Well, we meet. We have what are called MART books, which are much like the APS circuit books. These are our own club's MART book. That's another service that our club has, is a MART. And so the chapters can receive a group of books for each meeting, and that's one of the activities that we have at our meeting and that other clubs in the SCC have. We also then have trading between the members, and each month we have a program. Either one of our own members speaks on a topic that they're interested in or knowledgeable on. We have club auctions. Our November meeting, November 2014 meeting, will include an auction that our members can sign pieces from. Mostly the material in our auction is Scandinavian material.
I've seen that there's some very unique postal marks on different countries' mail. Can you think of one?
Well, there's several, but they're mostly older ones. Now, one of the things that I don't like is that the Swedes now have gone to inkjet markings, which I think are kind of damaging to the stamps. They don't look as nice as the circular date cancel, for example. But there are some, they are some different figures. If you collect a whole cover, that you could, there might be a chair or a church or something that is part of the design.
Oh, okay. Then, so inkjet markings, meaning they pass it through a machine.
That's right.
That
there.
Just prints it on there.
Exactly, or? Like your inkjet on the table in front of you.
Oh, so there's no stamp anymore.
No, they're not stamped.
It's
inkjet cancel. And there's people that actually collect those.
Are it's they kind of fancier, or they have dates or pictures, or?
Well, they have the date, and they have a picture, and usually the city. Although now we've gone towards, in Sweden and Denmark, towards postal centers. So the town postmarks really don't exist as they used to.
Wow, that used to be something you'd go to a town and collect just to say you've been there. Now it's just like a general grouping of...
That's right, that's right. The times are changing. In fact, my collection upstairs, my exhibit is of postal history from Lund in Sweden. And that's all it is the different cancels and different types of mail that were used in this city. And so you can see all the different cancels that were used in the time. Also, another very popular collecting style in Sweden, particularly, is to collect town cancels on the Oscar issues. The Oscar issues are from the 1890s and going into the early 20th century. And they're very inexpensive stamps. The minimum value, you know, they're the cheapest stamps you can find in Scott's catalog. But this is the issue that the Swedes prefer to collect the town cancels on.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. I've learned a lot about Swedish postal history and that I could have never known otherwise. So,
well, don't forget Norway and Denmark and Iceland and Finland. These are important collecting areas in our club, too. Thanks so much, Jessica.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurse, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
Hi, my name is Carl Schaff II. I'm the General Chairman of CESCO. And we are here at Stamp Show Here Today making this podcast for you.
Thank you for joining us at Stamp Show Here Today. You can email us your questions at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com or hit us up on Facebook and Twitter. And keep collecting.